a crucial difference, my understanding is, between your reading of history and those of some of your new historian mm-hmm. compatriots. They have a different approach to oral history and the
Absolutely.
Use of oral history
that
and the validity
true.
Thereof. And I've heard relatively convincing criticisms from both directions. So mm-hmm. how would you explain how you've incorporated into your own research and how you deal with the caveats that others have brought up?
Absolutely. I think there are three points to be said about oral history. First of all, that's the only way that we can hear the voice of the victim, of the underprivileged, the powerless, the defeated. There's no other way of hearing the voices without oral history, in modern history. So that's one reason we have to use it, while being aware that memory betrays people, with all the caveats. But we cannot give it up, because that's the main voice that the people have. Even if it comes as a story that people heard from the parents, if the voices we want to hear are already gone. That's the first point. Second point is about trauma. People who witnessed rape, massacre, expulsion may get the details wrong, quite possible. They may get the day wrong. They may get the numbers of people who committed the crimes wrong. They may not identify correctly the weapons that were used, absolutely. But they don't get wrong the crime. You don't get, I don't know whether you've gone into it. I've gone a lot into the narrative of abused people on every level before I did oral history. You can't reconstruct, even for legal purposes, you cannot establish a crime of abuse without oral history. There's no documents. Rapists don't leave a written document in the archive, I raped someone. And then the judge says, oh, if you don't have the document where the rapist said that he raped, I don't accept your narrative. He accepts the narrative of the victim. And I'm talking about, of course, the cases I was interested in were cases, historical cases. Not something that happened a week before. You
right.
know?
This is one of the key challenges,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Because people's memory.
And I looked in Canada in the cases of abused children by the Catholic Church. People were sent to jail on the basis of evidence given by kids 20 years after the crimes were committed. Even when some of these bastards did not admit to what they did. Because the humanity has provided us with enough mechanism to know when someone has gone through a horrible event in their life. So I was not using oral history for finding out on the Palestinian side or finding out what Israel did. I wanted to have the Palestinian voice and experience, and I found many things. And of course, if you can corroborate it later with documents of the United Nations and so on, fine.
So does that mean that you take that...
Wait a minute, let me give the third
please,
point.
Go ahead, please, go
ahead. It has to be completed. The third point is, I think military documents are full of lies and fabrication. I don't treat them as the truth and nothing but the truth. I think they're also, even if they're written on the spot, people hide things. People fabricate things. So we have to be skeptical about everything. Oral history, documented history. I don't think the hierarchy is that a document written by an Israeli officer has more validity than the memory of a Palestinian. They have different problems of authenticity. The one is, the caveat is memory. The other one is authenticity or truthfulness.
Transparency.
Transparency. I wouldn't trust any report coming from the Israeli army from the West Bank today. And I would trust the Palestinian testimony, what the Israeli soldier did, much more than I would trust the written report of the Israeli soldier. In fact, I would throw out to the dustbin the Israeli report.
What do you say to arguments that people have an inherent incentive because of this the intense political context? People have an incentive to exaggerate, not even exaggerate necessarily knowingly, but there's, you know, people have internal motivations to, mm-hmm. Play up certain elements and downplay other elements to serve what they view as an eventual just goal. The ends justify the means in some sense.
That doesn't tally with the reality. Our biggest problem with the Palestinians was that they didn't want to talk about 48. like the Holocaust survivors. They didn't. People don't want to go back to a terrible thing that happened to them. We had worked very hard in convincing Palestinians to tell the story. And Israel is very amazing in this respect. And evidence of a Jewish survivor from the Holocaust is sacred. And evidence of a Palestinian survivor from a massacre is a figment of their imagination. So you need the same methodology.
I put exactly that question to Benny Morris, and he said the difference in his mind, so I'm interested to hear what you say in response.
Yeah, okay.
The difference in his mind is that the oral histories that were coming out after the Holocaust were almost immediate. You had people that had just experienced that, and they were giving statements at the time, and those were also corroborated by Allied armies who saw the aftermath. And there were many points of corroboration, both from the individuals themselves that suffered and also from people that observed. And it was at the time. Whereas now, Morris says, if you go and you interview people about something that happened decades ago, you know, you have different people that have come together and they've shared their stories, and what you get is sort of almost an archetypal memory that describes experiences but doesn't necessarily give you any believable information about the details of what happened when to whom.
Yeah. I wonder where he makes up these things. Most of the research, academic research on the Holocaust, is based with interviews with people who survived the camps and the Holocaust years after the Holocaust. I don't know where he makes it up, these things. The only place where you had some evidence, the beginning of evidence given by Jewish survivors, was around the Eichmann trial, 62. I don't know where he makes up these things and where they come up from. I don't know, in order to, I don't know, substantiate. No, I don't think it's a valid position. Time is a factor, of course. And as I said, you need to know, and there's great, Morris is totally innocent of any theoretical, philosophical reading on history. You need to read Portelli and the big names of oral history. They guide you very well into what you can get from oral history or what you can't. So I said you can't get the details, but believe me, someone who was abused, someone who, you know, the stories of, just now I was working with a Jordanian Palestinian director on a movie that happened in a village. Her aunt, as a daughter, she was 12 years old, and she was locked for 4 days in a village without food, nearly died, and she saw through the keyhole things that happened in the village. People don't forget this. Even if you're 90, you don't forget it. I don't forget. I know, the thing you do as an historian, you ask about yourself. I know the things I cannot reconstruct in my life. Believe me, the traumatic events I went through are vivid in my memories if they happened yesterday. As if they happened yesterday. So I don't think that you can undermine this by such an argument. First of all, I don't think it's true. I think most of the research is based on post-Holocaust memories long after the event. And secondly, we are using it all over the world in order to reconstruct the history of indigenous people, of native people, with much longer time. We are reconstructing the history of the American slaves with stories that were running in the families. Not even, we don't have the eyewitnesses. We have, you know, we have diaries sometimes. We have memories that were passed from one generation to the other. It is a very important source that, of course, becomes even more valid when it is corroborated. So, for instance, I'll give you an example. If a dry report by the army says, unfortunately, in the village of Ilabun, our soldiers committed some things that they shouldn't have done, and they don't detail it. They just say, you know, and the people of Ilabun remember exactly what these soldiers did, even 70 years after. That's a very valid thing to put in your footnote. Very valid. So I don't agree. I think oral history, as I said, has the same problem as documented history.
Meaning it's equally problematic.
Equally problematic for different reasons. For different reasons. So we as historians, we use all kinds of things. We use common sense. We use imagination. We emplot. We create a narrative out of the material. And there's a great saying by E.H. Carr, who said, to compliment an historian about the facts and not about his narrative is like complimenting an architect about the material he chose, but not about the format, the form of the building. And I think that's true of the timber. So he said the quality of the timber. I remember now the quote. Quality of the timber. In other words, facts have to be established, no doubt. You cannot invent facts, for sure. But you are allowed to use your imagination, your common sense, to create a certain narrative out of all the material that you have. What you have to do is to be very transparent. And when I reconstructed a meeting, for instance, that I think took place in the 9th of March, I didn't have the minutes of the meeting. So I wrote in a footnote. I think that meeting had happened in this way by the product of that meeting, the master document, by some reference in Ben-Gurion's diary, some notes I got from interviews. But I admit, this is all I had. You, as a reader, can decide whether I went too far or not. For me, I didn't go too far. But I'm absolutely open. If people want to say, you know, you don't have exactly all the material about that meeting, which is true. But, to my mind, it went this way. So I didn't, for example, what I did not invent is what people said to each other. I couldn't. I said what happened in the meeting, in terms of describing a general process.
In terms of method, I'm curious, because it especially in this particular historical context,
right.
there's also a language difference, right? So there's the documents you're referring to are written in Hebrew. So a lot of the oral testimonies are in Arabic. So the translation process from one language to the other, do you ever encounter difficulty capturing the spirit of what's said in one language? Rather than the literal word for word truth,
I have perfect command in both languages. Benny Morris doesn't know a word of Arabic. It's also a problem. It's one of the reasons he didn't use oral history. He doesn't know the language. I didn't encounter any problem there. In fact, I think that it's very interesting. Zionist apologetics, and Morris became one recently, for what Israel did, would like to argue about the details, about the facts, Palestinian historians would like to argue about the moral implication of what Israel did. And I think in the end of the day, as I said, ethnic cleansing is not allowing people to live in their homeland. You did it like this, you did it like that. We will continue to argue about that. But the Israelis will never get away with it, from it, you know? I think this is where the debate is now, actually.
You mean the domestic debate?
The domestic debate is about the moral issue. Because the right wing says, not only we should have kicked them out. In fact, Benny Morris says it in his new dress in 48. He says, we should have, if we didn't kick them out, they would have kicked us out. That's the notion. Now, this is an argument I can accept as an entry point for a discussion. I don't accept the argument, but I can understand it. I can argue. But if someone says to me, because you said it was at 8 o'clock in the morning, but actually it was at 9 o'clock in the morning, and therefore it was not an ethnic cleansing, I don't have any energy to go on with it. I said, okay, I changed it to 9 o'clock. Can we now move on, you know? But of course, this is a tactic. This is a tactic to say, oh, come on. He doesn't know it was 8 o'clock, so can you trust him on ethnic cleansing issues? So I think we luckily for us, this kind of style of debate is behind us. We are not arguing because Israel with the world.
Well, part of one of the reasons that I've had just a personal desire to engage in this material is because I think maybe not so much for my generation, but still one generation prior, my parents' generation. What you're describing is now sort of being accepted in the Israeli domestic context, and that's where the debate has shifted. Still is not.
No, for them not. For that generation, because they are complicit. Your parents' generation is much closer to the event. So if I say that they were a criminal society, that they will defend themselves. They will find every possible way of saying, no, you're wrong.
But I'm saying even in the diaspora, people,
from a certain generation. Yeah. I agree. But I think for the younger generation of Israelis, this comes back to the present reality. If the Palestinians would continue to struggle against us, they should be warned. We can kick them out again. And we would have the right to do it. I mean, Israel is doing things which are as bad as ethnic cleansing to the Palestinians. And the Israeli society supports it fully, more than 90%.
Right. Which
So it means that, let's say Israel decides to expel 1 million Palestinians from the West Bank. I don't know how the world would react. I know how the Jewish society in Israel would react. It would have no problem with that. The vast majority. There will be people who would have a lot of problem with it. I agree. And I think some brave Jews would come and even lie on the street, if you want, to support it. But the vast majority of Israelis would say, if the government thinks that that's the only way to stop terror and so on, unfortunately, this should be done.
Which brings me right to the point that we should probably end on, because I have to go. But I don't want it to end on sort of a cliched note.
Right.
You know, so how do we solve it all? How do we wrap it all up?
Right.
But what you mentioned at the beginning is some acknowledgement of the complicity of, if not the current generation, the previous generation, in precisely what we do know now historically did happen. What you can argue about the morality of it, right, or the moral context. You seem to be arguing that some acknowledgement, and I imagine admission of guilt or apology, would be just a priori necessity to move the current impasse in any positive direction. How do you see that as even being possible, given the context you just described, where people feel under pressure from what they regard as terrorism, from the things that Hamas and you know, the open-air prison that is Gaza have been saying for the past however many decades? I mean, maybe there is no answer. Maybe it really is just a tragedy, right? With no, and you just have to shrug.
No. I'm an activist. I don't accept it. I'm not an observer. I'm an activist.
So from a realist.
No, I'm sure I have the answer to your question. Of course, we've been doing it for the last 40 years. I know what I'm doing. I remember in South Africa, visiting a few times. One of the things that really struck me was that talking to white people in South Africa who told me
after apartheid,
they said we were totally convinced that apartheid was morally justified, and we were totally convinced that if we ever give up apartheid, we would be slaughtered by the Africans. And they said to me, you know, many of us still believe apartheid is better than what we have. So I said, so why are you not doing anything? They said, well, it's very interesting. They said, publicly, we go through a process. First of all, we understand we should say publicly that we are against apartheid. We even have to show that we were against apartheid, although we were not. But as the time passes by, we really become less and less convinced that apartheid was a good idea. So it takes time. So what I'm learning from this is to have the political process of symbolic acknowledgement, let's say, you don't need to convince every Israeli Jew to make the acknowledgement. You don't need to deprogram every Zionist. You need to find the reality by which a political leadership says, even not genuinely, for the sake of reconciliation, we are making this kind of acknowledgement, and then see how it works. Now, that's one way of doing it. The other thing that we are doing, and I agree, I think there are certain generations we have lost, but I think that's why the work that Zohrot is doing and others are doing, it's education. I see one of my son's generation, much easier to talk with them about the need to acknowledge. Much easier than with their parents. A, they didn't live through that period. They have a much more universalist point of view. I'm not talking about everyone, because Israeli. There's two interesting processes in Israel, and it would be very interesting to see how they engage with each other. From above, the Ministry of Education, the political elite, wants to create another generation of fanatic, racist, ethnic Jews. That's the program of the Israeli educational system. However, that generation is also, Israel doesn't put, for the time being, any inhibition or restrictions on connecting through cyberspace to the rest of the world. So this is a confused generation. They have an international universal point of view, and they have an educational system that wants to push them in exactly the opposite direction. Exactly the opposite direction. We are using this gap to try and widen the gap, the contradiction between the Israeli education system program and our program. Let's say our, the activists. And I think we are successful, but in a very slow pace. But I'll tell you the truth. I think the days of Zionism or Israel as a Jewish state are numbered. Unnumbered. I'm not sure whether I hope they're not numbered because they will be defeated by the Muslim and Arab world once they get over their own problems. I pray to God this is not the scenario that would happen. But I think they're numbered in a different way because of the moral dimension that is important to the younger generation. And the younger generation's reaction to the crisis, like the 2008 reaction. This is what brought will bring Jeremy Corbyn to the prime minister. It will bring Bernie Sanders and like him back to politics. This is an impulse that also exists among young people in Israel that you don't see it because here the government fights it in every possible way. That's why they're haunting soldiers against silence in such a way, because they understand that, I saw it in my younger son's class. Someone came, Noam came to talk to them. They loved him. He convinced them. And the teachers were...
How old were these kids? Just sort of curiosity.
17 and 18. And the teachers were worried. One third of my son's class did not go to the army. One third of my son's class out of 36 did not go. Now, not all of them said we're not going ideologically. Some found excuse. No, Israel.
That's an unprecedented change.
Yeah. No, Israel. Israel. There is this inability of us, as observers, to understand where it's going. And I don't have a good answer for you. Where is it going? I don't know. But I'm an activist, so I don't care where it's going. I know what I have to do. Okay. What I have to do is to say yes. You're right. The electorate. You know, people of certain age, certain generation. By the way, Sfaradi, Ashkenazi, doesn't matter, seem to like the right-wing version of Israel. They think it's working. Maybe they don't even like it, but they think it's the only thing that works because you have terror, you have Iran, you have the Arab Spring. Trump is helping, saying, you see, we even have an American president who understands us, you know, better than this bastard Obama. Okay, but I'm saying this is one direction. There is this other direction that is not controlled. I don't know, maybe they will try and control it. But I think as activists, we should enhance it. By the way, the Palestinians have a similar problem, surprisingly. Similar problem in a different way. The old Palestinian political elite believes nationalism is the way forward. A national liberation movement, that's why many of them still support the two-state solution, said we need a nation state. You read the young people's correspondents in Facebook, Twitter, they don't want a nation state. They want to live in a state that you have equal rights as citizens. They want a one democratic state, much more. But they are not, they don't want the Fatah, they don't want the Hamas, they don't want the joint list. They want a world of freedom. And this is something that happened in the Arab world in 2011. People said to the Egyptian government, yes, you liberated us from the British, but what life do we have as a liberator? You liberated the land, but not the people. Now, we saw how the Arab regimes reacted. I warn you that the Israeli regime can react in a similar way. I think the Palestinian regime, hopefully, will not react in a similar way, because it's a far more complex situation. They are under occupation. But it stands to reason the third uprising would be much more against the Palestinian Authority than against Israel to begin with. So we have this And the uprising will not be to throw out the PA in order to create a state. It would to say we don't like the fragmentation of the Palestinians of different groups. We don't like the way you don't talk about the right of return anymore. We don't like the way that you say that Haifa is not part of Palestine. We want all these things. We need to arrest these impulses and energies to the right agenda, which is a human rights agenda, civil rights agenda. Israel can be defeated on a human rights agenda. I don't think it can be defeated on the national right agenda anymore. It could be maybe in the 50s, 60s, I don't know, or in the 30s rather, 1930s. So my hope is that I'm not losing hope, because I don't think politics is just politics from above. I don't think only the elites have politics and a say. So I look at Palestine from bottom up, I'm optimistic. I look at Palestine from above, I'm very worried, I'm frightened, I don't know what's going to happen. But as an activist, I go to the place where I'm more optimistic, and I ask myself, can I enhance those forces which I think are positive? And as I say, also on the Palestinian side, not on the Jewish side. I want positive forces on the Palestinian side as well. And I think we should unite under human rights, civil rights position, which Zionism is against. I think national movements as a whole are not a great idea. They find nationalism also would find it very difficult to respect basic human rights as a right, and we have enough examples.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem like it's going anywhere nationally.
No,
we're seeing it now with, ironically, as you were describing the quote unquote Muslim immigration problem.
Right.
In Europe, you're seeing that people are very, as soon as they're confronted with having to give any small inch of their nationalist the water that they swim in, so to speak. Immediately people.
But look what happened in England. Look what happened in England. What changed the political scene in England? You know what changed it? That a group of people between the age of 18 and 24 who never voted before decided to vote. And they voted only for one person. They didn't even vote for one party. They voted for one person, 76 years old, interestingly enough. Why? Because the middle, and they were right, the middle ground, kind of the middle-aged, if you want, do not convey authenticity. This old person who used to argue, demonstrate against nuclear weapons, supported the Irish struggle, comes out as an idealist. So we never thought in Britain that the right-wing xenophobia would be met by a young, naive, if you want, not naive to my mind, by a young ideological response. We thought we needed, as the old-timers, to fight against them. There's no need for us. There's no need for us. The people in Glastonbury, two, three, I don't know if you saw it. You saw the clip with Jeremy Corbyn. I don't know if you saw it.
Not that one, no.
I'll show it to you when we finish. It's amazing. Half a million people cheer him up, 76 or whatever his age is, I don't know. Old-timer, people who came for music and fun and love, treat him as a pop star. Why? Why do they? And all of them waving the Palestinian flag, interesting.
Right, because there's something, they see something authentic there that they don't see elsewhere, right?
And they think that Palestine, rightly or wrongly, represents this authenticity. That's where Israel has a problem. That the people who don't even know where Palestine is are waving the Palestinian flag. Because this is for them the epitome of double talk, injustice. And it's not objectively correct. I mean, there are worse place areas in the world, but that doesn't matter. Israel symbolizes for that generation everything that is wrong in
this
world.
It's a lightning rod.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And the Israelis cannot use F-16 against this problem. They know how to deal with terrorism, but they don't know how to deal with moral objection to the Jewish state.
On that note, I don't know if this is something that people have put to you before, but we can end here.
Okay.
So we have to go. But given the possibility of someone like Corbyn on the horizon in the UK specifically,
yeah, right?
As you were mentioning, the necessity of some sort of acknowledgement, even if it's duplicitous, some sort of acknowledgement of the previous generation of Israel's complicity in what happened at the founding of the state. Is there not something to be said for the fact that the imperial powers themselves, like England, have yet to apologize, let alone for their global colonial project, but specifically for their role in the completely paradoxical promises they made to both sides. Would that not be just a simple low-hanging fruit for someone like a Corbyn to come forward and say, we apologize for the role we played in raising false promises?
Why do you think the Jewish lobby tried to hunt him down, as Al Jazeera showed in the brilliant film The Lobby? Why do you think the Israeli and Jewish lobby is working against Corbyn?
Because do you think he would make that apology?
Of course. I'm sure that when the Balfour Declaration would be commemorated and Theresa May would say, we're so happy we gave the Balfour Declaration, Jeremy would come to our meeting in the Palestine Solidarity Committee. I have no doubt about it. He would come to lament the Balfour Declaration. He would play it carefully. He's a politician. He would say Israel is an established fact. We should recognize the Jewish state. But yes, he would definitely acknowledge that Britain had a very important role. He already did it.
It's not just the Balfour Declaration.
No.
In my mind, anyway, because they were literally the different wings of the foreign
absolutely.
Service making different promises.
Absolutely, Corbyn would have no problem in acknowledging it, really. I don't want to speak in his name, but I worked with him in the Solidarity Movement, definitely until this time, moment in time, this is his position. You ask me.
It's very hard for me to imagine an Israeli, anyone in Israeli leadership even rising to a position of prominence who would be willing to do that if the example is not set by
well, I don't know.
At least a little less to lose.
I think what would force Israel to make the apologies if the alternative would be worse. I think, unfortunately, Israel understands only the language of power.
But would an example help?
Yeah, it will help. It will help. It will definitely help. And maybe it's easier to get it out of Britain than to get it from Israel to begin with. Yeah, I think so. There's a huge campaign called the Balfour Project that millions of British have enlisted to. They want to have a very different commemoration in the 2nd of November 1917.
But even that, couldn't that be construed as inherently pro-Palestinian by the people on the Israeli side? Whereas if there's an apology just for the role of Britain...
I understand what you're saying. That should be easier for the British to do it.
Exactly.
I think that's possible. Well, that's possible. I'm less optimistic than you are that this would be such a big impact on the Israelis themselves.
Are you a UK citizen? I'm just curious.
No, I'm not.
But regardless, you have some sway there, I see.
I have, No, it's a good idea. I think it's a good idea. But I'm really worried by the way that the British government is going to celebrate Balfour. That's for me is a bit too much. Let alone, don't do anything. Okay, so just say 100 years ago we gave the declaration, but they are going, Theresa May is going to come to the Israeli embassy, someone from the royal family is going to come to the Israeli embassy. I mean, they're going to say Britain gave the world something beautiful, which is called the Balfour Declaration, and that's bad. And that's why I think the only thing you can do for the time being is to have a counter event, just to mention. But I agree with you, I think it is. All in all, I think it's very good for both the Israelis and the Palestinians to know that they are not exceptional in what they did to each other and what they experienced. Actually, to contextualize it, I just think that the Palestinians have far more readiness to accept it than the Israelis do. Anyway,
Thank
I think
so
we
much.
Should do that. Here, Jonathan.